Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Kimberly Cronick for Craig Cohen. The National Cancer Institute estimates that 1 in 8 American women born today will be diagnosed with breast cancer sometime in her lifetime. It's the most common non-skin cancer among U.S. women and the second leading cause of cancer death after lung cancer. The looped pink ribbon has come to symbolize the mainstream breast cancer movement in the United States and increasingly worldwide. Corporations from pharmaceutical companies to automakers, gun manufacturers, and food giants have used the pink ribbon to sell their products to an eager public wanting to make a difference through consumer-oriented activism and participation in massive 5K Race for the Cure fundraising events. The emphasis of the mainstream breast cancer movement is on raising money for specific kinds of breast cancer research and early detection through mammograms. But are these the best strategies? Where do these strategies come from? And what kind of research is being done? How is the movement shaped by cause-driven marketing and capitalism? We'll discuss these questions and your questions and comments as we go beyond the pink ribbon to the politics of breast cancer, civic engagement, and corporate philanthropy. And we'll do this with my in-studio guest, Samantha King, Associate Professor with the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She's the author of a 2006 book, Pink Ribbons, Inc. In 2011, the book was made into a documentary by the same name. That documentary will be shown at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana tomorrow night at 7. The film screening and Q&A are presented by the U of I's Department of Kinesiology and Community Health and the Center on Health, Aging, and Disability. Samantha King, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much.
And we welcome your questions and comments. To join the conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or I'll be monitoring our email account. You can send your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, Samantha, I'll start with a question. Why a massive breast cancer awareness and fundraising movement? If we look at breast cancer just in terms of who it strikes and who it kills, we see that it's not the number one killer of women in the U.S. or worldwide. We know that lung cancer kills more women than any other cancer and that heart disease kills more women than all other cancers. So how is it that breast cancer has become the focus of corporate philanthropists?
The first thing I would say is that 30 years ago, it would have been unimaginable that corporations would be clamoring to attach their name to breast cancer. So in that sense, it's not that different than heart disease or lung cancer would have been at that time. It was highly stigmatized. But over the past 30 or 40 years, there's been an effort to sanitize the disease and to disassociate it from what we have come to think of, rightly or wrongly, as poor lifestyle choices like smoking or eating too much fat. More importantly than that, I think, though, is that the breast has become a highly valued cultural symbol. It's linked to sexuality and it's linked to motherhood. And it's that value that nonprofit organizations and corporations have played upon in order to market the disease and fundraising to the public.
So even though ovarian cancer is a particular cancer to women, that just probably wouldn't sell.
Not right now, and it would take some pretty creative marketing, as it did with breast cancer, to change that situation.
And tell us a little bit about marketing and just a little bit about the history of corporate philanthropy and how breast cancer fits into that. When did corporations start to give to causes, and has that changed over time?
Well, interestingly enough, it wasn't until the 1950s that corporations were even allowed to give money to charities that went to a case went to the courts, and it was decided that it was okay to spend shareholders' money on things other than or their money on anything really other than profit making. But it wasn't until the 1980s that corporations began to see philanthropy as something that could directly contribute to their bottom line. Before that, it was really the domain of executives who would give this or that amount to their favorite cause. But it became, in the 1980s, something that was highly strategic and directly linked to the bottom line. If we donate this amount of money, then we need to see this much return, and we'll ensure that through marketing particular products and services.
Didn't this also coincide with the shift in government response to public health issues in the U.S.? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Exactly. Well, under the administration of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, there was very great emphasis placed on shifting responsibility from government for the health and welfare of the people to corporations. Policies were enacted to encourage corporate and private giving to ensure health and welfare. And actually, that kind of policy approach has only grown under the next few administrations, right up to Barack Obama, so that now we take it for granted in some ways that private or corporate philanthropy is supposed to be a preferable way to provide public services.
And what are there inherent problems with that kind of assumption?
There are, in my view, many problems with that assumption, not least of which corporations are profit-driven. And if their interests don't line up with public health interests, we're not going to have very effective public health policies. And that's been the case with breast cancer. It's a primary example of the lack of progress we've made in terms of prevention and treatment, I think, is directly related to the privatized approach to the disease.
And when we think about what a woman who is diagnosed with breast cancer's options are, those are still today surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, or to not seek treatment and maybe have hospice and let the disease, you know, play out without treatment. Those are still the options today after years of research and correct.
Exactly. It's over 50 years since Nixon declared the war on cancer in the United States, and women essentially have the same options what breast cancer surgeon Dr. Susan Love calls slash burn and poison. As she says it in the film, there's slightly less surgery, slightly more chemotherapy. But over the last few months, I've been hearing from more and more women who've pointed out to me that they had breast cancer 30 years ago and they've just had a recurrence, and they're going through exactly the same kinds of treatments. They're just maybe doing so in slightly more comfortable or plush hospital settings, especially if they have access to those kinds of facilities.
Well, if you've just joined the conversation, on today's Focus, we're looking beyond the pink ribbon to the politics of breast cancer, civic engagement, and corporate philanthropy. And my guest is Samantha King with the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She's the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc. The book was made into a documentary by the same name that will air tomorrow night at the Spurlock Museum at 7 p.m. And you're welcome. Your questions and comments are welcome. To join the conversation, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at will-talk.illinois.edu. I do have a question here. Let's see if I can pull it up right now. Let's see. Okay, here's a question here. It says, do you understand the nature of sport in regard to your work? For example, people, including intellectuals, often can't seem to fathom that sport can be analyzed sport seems innocent, son, frivolous. People's response to theorizing of sport, how dare you put all this heavy stuff on sport? So in other words, she's saying the question is, if people just want to have fun with sports and not make a political, what we know is that a lot of fundraising for breast cancer these days is through Race for the Cures, and that's often led by the Komen Foundation. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I actually came to this research in part through my interest in the politics of sport and physical activity. I thought it was very interesting that hundreds of thousands of people every year were putting on their running shoes and their pink t-shirts and taking to the streets, running and walking in the name of raising money for charity. And I think it's quite symbolic that people use their bodies in this way, and that that has become an extremely legitimate way of raising money in a way that it wouldn't have been 50 years ago. Those kinds of walks and runs were unheard of. So for this analysis, and particularly the ways in which individual responsibility for health has been crucial to the kinds of messages that we're offered around breast cancer. You should get mammograms. You should see your doctor if you're concerned. You should, you know, make the right treatment choices, which means agreeing to the drugs and the radiation and the surgery. And to me, that's all very much bound up with this idea that if you participate in physical activity, you'll also help prevent breast cancer. So those two things are very closely related.
And you have a chapter in the book about when the NFL sponsored, mm-hmm. back in, was it 99, sponsored, mm-hmm. Race for the Cure. Tell me a little bit about that. We're talking about sports, right. And why they signed on and some of the racial implications, mm-hmm. of that.
Yes, and the NFL had an agreement with Komen, which they announced with a press release entitled Real Men Wear Pink. And they did that at a time when the media was very much focused on what they called a character issue in the NFL, highly racialized and moralizing media coverage about the activities of some of the players. And so the NFL had discovered, actually, that women made up a much higher percentage of the viewership for Monday Night Football and decided to create this breast cancer campaign. And to me, that was extremely interesting because they produced a series of videos that featured NFL players who were mostly African American, doing good charitable deeds, participating in the Race for the Cure with very typical looking breast cancer survivors, white women, slim, young, ultra feminine. This is the image of the breast cancer survivor that's been used to sell the disease and to sell breast cancer related products more generally, and we can talk about why that may be a problem later. But I argue in the book that this was a way of managing the character crisis in the NFL in ways that really reinforce the idea that breast cancer is a disease primarily that affects white women, and that it is white and middle-class women that we should be primarily concerned about. And that's one of the assumptions that I really try to unpack in my research.
And when we look at who is getting diagnosed with breast cancer, it is more white women than other race women. However, the death rate among breast cancer is higher among women of color, particularly African-American women.
Absolutely. And in the United States, especially when those figures are bandied about, people tend to go immediately to genetic explanations. That's where most of the research money goes. One of the things that I've written about in my research is the need for us to actually have a class analysis of breast cancer. And of course, class and race intersect in ways that mean that African American women are overrepresented among poor and uninsured women in the U.S. And if you actually look at the research, it's late diagnosis, it's lack of access to treatment, environmental racism, the fact that people of color and poor people are much more likely to live close to contaminated industrial sites that produce these inequalities. Even in Canada, where I live, where there's socialized medicine, poor women and working class women die at higher rates. And that has to do with things like lack of access to childcare or transportation to complete chemotherapy regimens, having to work while they're sick, and also again late diagnosis, lack of access to really good healthcare.
I want to talk a little bit about one of the inspirations for your book, which was Audre Lorde's book from 1980, The Cancer Journals. Audre Lorde being an African-American woman, lesbian, activist, poet, writer, who wrote eloquently about her disease documented in the book and how it was important to talk with other women about the disease, but also use that for political action to actually make change in the system. How do you see Audre Lorde's analysis and what's going on today?
I think Audre Lorde could see into the future. It's really incredible to read that book now, because she warns us that although hope is important when you have an illness, a diagnosis, that apolitical hope, or hope that is not attached to some kind of social goal, is really dangerous. And she imagines what it would be like if an army of one-breasted women descended on Congress demanding that hormones in beef be outlawed because of their links to breast cancer. And what we see now is an army of one-breasted women, not necessarily visible in their one-breastedness, racing for the cure, full of optimism and hope, on the grounds of the mall in Washington every year, but really thoroughly detached from any notion of social change that Lorde was advocating for so eloquently.
And that comes in, let's go back to the corporatization, like you said, of the pink ribbon, that relates to a question that just came in. The difference between what you were just saying and mobilizing for change, societal, systemic change, and the kind of change that you might be able to enact through buying something. Mm-hmm. And there's been some controversy about the pink buckets of fried chicken sold by Kentucky Fried Chicken. And can you talk a little bit about that, about that relationship between that product and, I believe it was linked to money that would go to the Susan G. Komen mm-hmm. for the Cure Foundation? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, this was 2010, I believe. The Komen Foundation partnered with KFC, with the Pink Buckets of KFC for the Cure campaign. Very soon after that campaign was launched, people began to ask questions, especially people who work in nutrition and public health. Here was a, at that point, very well-respected foundation that had as its mission to see a world without breast cancer, partnering with a corporation that makes really bad food and markets that food especially to poor people who or can't afford to buy other kinds of foods. And in the state of California at that time, there was a lawsuit actually around the carcinogens that are used in one of the particular chicken products that KFC sells. The campaign did run its course, but it disappeared. It hasn't been seen again. It's just one example, though a particularly egregious example, I think, of the disconnect between what it is that many of these big breast cancer foundations say they want to do and want to achieve, and then how they achieve it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Susan G. Komen Foundation and how it started. I know it was started by a sister of a Tell us a little bit about the history of that and where they've, why they started and where they are now. We can get in a little bit later about the controversy in February about them pulling funding from Planned Parenthood. But let's just start with, what is Susan G. Komen? Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, it's one of the largest breast cancer foundations in the world. The Avon Cosmetics Corporation actually has a very large breast cancer foundation that raises a lot of money, too. Komen's is the more prominent, though, definitely in the U.S., and was founded by Nancy Brinker, who went on to be George W. Bush-appointed ambassador to Hungary and is now the cancer ambassador for the World Health organization, and she founded the organization in memory of her sister, Susie, who had died from breast cancer. They were both actually from Peoria, Illinois, although the organization is now based in Dallas, Texas. From the very beginning, Nancy Brinker wanted to partner with corporations, and she was very aggressive about pursuing those partnerships, although in the early days apparently had quite a bit of trouble getting people to sign on because of the stigmatization around the disease. But she ultimately succeeded, and she created these networks of Race for the Cures and Run for the Cures. And really, until the Planned Parenthood controversy earlier this year, has largely succeeded, I think, in winning the American public over to that particular mode of approaching the disease, the pink ribbon products, and the large fundraising walks and runs, and an emphasis on screening and treatment and not prevention.
So let's talk about what happened in February. We had the Komen Foundation had pulled funding from Planned Parenthood and said it because of a congressional investigation. They later gave the money, didn't pull the funding, and said they Planned Parenthood had not been charged with any crime. And we know that Planned Parenthood doesn't provide mammography. They do provide, though, manual breast exams. What's your takeaway from that controversy, and what concerns do you have, if any, about that?
To those of us who have been following the Komen for a number of years, this really wasn't surprising. And that's one thing I really like to emphasize when people ask me about this. This was just the latest in a series of poor ethical choices and bad public relations exercises on the part of the Komen Foundation. They had the KFC controversy. The Wall Street Journal had published an investigative report a year or so earlier about the Komen's aggressive pursuit of small mom-and-pop charities in the U.S. that are using For the Cure, which they own, those three words that we're using For the Cure in their fundraising efforts. And so really, and also I should say, have for a long, long time been very closely tied to the Republican Party, though they had tried to toe a middle line politically and to keep the controversy around Planned Parenthood, which the right had been pushing for a long time, pushing Komen to disconnect from Planned Parenthood for a long time, but they had managed to keep that under the radar. And when this story broke about the decision to defund Planned Parenthood, I have to say, although I wasn't shocked at all that Komen made that decision, I was really pleasantly surprised by the public response. I've never seen anything like that in terms of the outrage that was expressed, not least because Planned Parenthood provides health care for huge numbers of uninsured American women. And I think that's something that many people didn't realize until this controversy broke.
And I think that's a good segue into talking about the breast cancer movement and how it's different and similar from other disease-based movements. And we can talk about that in a minute, but I want to remind our listeners that you are welcome to join the conversation. If you've just joined us, we're looking beyond the pink ribbon to the politics of breast cancer, civic engagement, and corporate philanthropy. I'm Kimberly Cronick, and my guest is Samantha King with the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She's the author of the book Pink Ribbons, Inc. That book was made into a documentary that's going to be shown tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana, and she'll be there to watch the film with you and to take your questions. We're going to go to a short break, and then we come back. Let's talk a little bit about the differences in the movements, but let's take a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, J.R. Moringer talks about his new novel, Sutton, based on bank robber Willie Sutton, who was a folk hero in an era when the public hated banks.
As good as he was at robbing banks, he was even better at escaping from prison.
Moringer also wrote the best-selling memoir, The Tender Bar. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 of the world's finest wines and draft beers.
And we're back in the studio with Samantha King with the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies, and she's the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc. We're talking about breast cancer, the politics, consumerism, activism, and corporate philanthropy. We do have a caller from line four, Cisna Park. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello. Yeah, thank you. Very interesting program. Thanks for taking my call. I'm old enough to remember back in the day, the Virginia Slims TV commercials, You've Come a Long Way, Baby, where they were tying supposedly women's liberation into the ability to buy cigarettes, smoke cigarettes, so on and so forth. And now it seems to me, just with the people I've interviewed, that somehow the idea is that women are smoking cigarettes because somehow, I don't know how this got to be, but the concept is if I smoke cigarettes, it'll keep my weight down. And I think that's a pretty dangerous game of Russian roulette. It's a very interesting program because on the surface, you would say helping a cause like breast cancer is great PR for anybody or any company, but politics do come into play. I was wondering if your guests had access to any research as far as the causations, if it was smoking, if it was obesity, or if it was food additives, or if it was all of the above. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for your question, Steve.
Well, certainly I'm an expert more in the politics of philanthropy than I am in the science of breast cancer, but I can offer what I know in response to your question. The biggest single risk factor for breast cancer is being a woman, also one's risk increases with age. And really, that's what we know. Beyond that, there is a heavy emphasis in the research funding on what are called lifestyle factors like diet and physical activity and so on. My understanding of that is that the research doesn't show that those factors make a huge difference. The research shows that environmental contaminants in the air we breathe, for example, have a stronger effect than the food we eat. Having said that, I think it's important to disentangle food in terms of calories from food in terms of quality. And it is important to think about just the amount of hormones and estrogenic hormones that are in the food that we eat. And there are certainly researchers who have shown very clearly a link between hormones in food and risk for all kinds of cancers. What I would like to see is less of a focus on these so-called lifestyle factors in preventative research and more of a focus on the environment, which allows us to look at the society as a whole as opposed to individual choices around food and exercise that explain very little in terms of breast cancer incidence.
So when we think of this kind of research for preventing it or causes, and we think about when I plunk a dollar down to buy something, a pink ribbon or a product with a pink ribbon on it, do I know how much of those research dollars are going toward prevention or environmental causes of breast cancer? Is there a way to find out?
Well, I can tell you that very little goes towards environmental research. It's extremely hard to find out where the money goes, how it is spent. I spent years trying to figure that out. Researchers for the film spent years trying to figure that out. Various consultants have spent years trying to figure that out. And that's one of the problems we're facing is the lack of transparency in this system that we're confronting. But in general, from what we know, less than 5% of research funds are spent on specifically the prevention in terms of the environment. And maybe around 15%, 10 to 15% is spent on prevention in general, research on prevention in general.
And does that have anything to do with corporate sponsorship of the breast cancer movement?
Absolutely. It's very hard for the Komen Foundation, who are so dependent on money from the oil and gas industries, the chemical industries, the pharmaceutical industries, who are so focused on cure, not prevention, from the mammography and screening industries, to go there. As Barbara Brenner says in the film, they can't go there. That's their bread and butter. And if they were to start talking about the environment and about pollutants and about prevention in a really serious way, they would likely lose that support.
When we talk about in the pink ribbon and what we kind of the immediate images of the breast cancer movement, we are, as you said, familiar with Komen a lot, and we've talked about them. There's another group that's grassroots that's been in the struggle a long time, the Breast Cancer Action. Can you talk a little bit about that and the mainstream breast cancer movement?
Yeah, so I try to distinguish between the mainstream breast cancer movement and the more critical wing of that movement. And Breast Cancer Action would be the most prominent group in the more critical wing. They have done an amazing job over the last two decades of questioning the corporate approach to the disease, of questioning the lack of emphasis on prevention, of questioning where the money goes and the pinking of the disease. And really, without them, there wouldn't be a prominent voice in the U.S. or even internationally questioning the direction that we've taken.
And do you know how they're funded? Where do they get?
Yeah, so they have very clear policies around donations. They don't accept money from any organization that benefits from breast cancer. So, for example, pharmaceutical companies that make breast cancer drugs, or from corporations that do breast cancer related marketing. So they rely on individual and private donations, but they're very careful about the kinds of organizations and individuals that they partner with so that they can continue to do the work that they do.
And I just want to let our listeners know that on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus, we do have links to both the Komen Foundation and Breast Cancer Action. So if you want to know more about those organizations, you can go there for links to them. If you've just joined the conversation, I'm Kimberly Cronick, and with me is Samantha King, Associate Professor at the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She's the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., and we're talking about breast cancer, the politics of it, the corporatization of it, disease in the U.S., and we would love for you to join the conversation. Your comments and questions are welcome at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or I am checking our email account. You can email me at will-talk@illinois.edu. When we look at the breast cancer movement today, and we look at other movements for change, such as AIDS and AIDS activism, how are they different and how are they the same? And can you insert in your answer the breast cancer research stamp that came out in, was it 90? First Lady Hillary Clinton sort of unveiled that, right? And that was in, when was that? What year was that? Do you remember that? It was 1998. That's right. It was 45 cents, and the funds for that stamp went to the National Cancer Institute and the Breast Cancer Research Program of the Department of Defense. There was an AIDS stamp as well. Can you put these two movements in context and how they're similar and how they're different?
Yeah. Well, other researchers have written quite extensively on the mutual influence of the women's health movement, the HIV/AIDS movement, and the breast cancer movement on one another. And when I say the mutual relationship, I'm talking about, of course, the more critical arm of the breast cancer movement. There was a lot of what theorists of social movements called social movement spillover, where people and ideas from the different movements moved between organizations over the course of their activist experience. But what I write about in the book is the ways in which the AIDS movement has maintained an ability to make connections to other issues like lack of housing, poverty, racism, sexism, and so on, in a way that the breast cancer movement has not. Of course, there's a mainstream HIV movement too, but somehow that movement has maintained its critical edge. The mainstream breast cancer movement has become very single issue focused, refuses for the most part to talk about anything that might disrupt this idea that breast cancer is really an individual responsibility best dealt with by raising money for research and finding a cure. In terms of the breast cancer stamp, it was the first stamp in the history of the United States to be sold at a rate above the letter rate, which means that it had to be approved by an act of Congress. And for each stamp sold, the extra money that is charged for that stamp goes to the Department of Defense Breast Cancer Research Program. So it was different from the AIDS stamp, which was not sold at a higher rate. It didn't have a fundraising purpose. It had more of an awareness purpose. Interestingly enough, the second stamp, and the only one that I'm aware of in the history of the United States to be sold at a rate above the letter rate, was the 9/11 stamp, with the images of the firefighters planting the flag at what we call Ground Zero. So I really think that speaks to the significance of breast cancer in the national imaginary in the last two decades.
When we look at movements for change, whether it's more dollars for research that we're talking about sort of in the mainstream, whether it's corporations seeing they can make more money by affiliating with this cause. Oh, and talk a little bit about those, you know, how much that corporation then gives to breast cancer. There were individual examples where it was not as much as I thought it might be. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when you enter a store and you see a pink ribbon product and you decide that you want to buy it because you think you might as well, if you're going, there's a choice between two products that are the same and one has a pink ribbon, claims it's going to lead to a donation to charity. A lot of people make that choice. Sometimes you'll be able to find some small print which says how much money is going to the cause. Often you won't be able to, and I've made phone calls to corporations and have often never received a satisfactory answer, which is interesting in itself. Most of the time, the donations are quite small, and there's a maximum amount that the corporation will donate. So in fact, what happens in reality is that these corporations sign an agreement with the foundation, and they hand over a check, often for $100,000 here in the U.S., so that means that well-intentioned and unsuspecting consumers are buying products, imagining that their purchase is going to make a difference. But in fact, that $100,000 has already been handed over, and anything that's purchased beyond that won't make a difference at all. It just remains in the coffers of the corporations. That money then, of course, goes to the Breast Cancer Foundation, and some of it will go to the overhead costs of that organization. Official figures say with the Komen Foundation, it's about 25% goes to overhead cost, and then the rest goes towards whatever their funding priorities are for that year.
We do have a call from Champaign Jennifer on line one. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm excited to see the film tomorrow. I was wondering, I have stage 4 breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer. I was wondering if you could talk about the disparity in funding for the cure, but the lack of funding that actually goes towards metastatic breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. I'm very sorry to hear about your diagnosis, Jennifer. It's, again, my expertise in this kind of area is limited, but I am aware of the lack of research support for metastatic breast cancer. You will see in the film tomorrow night women from a stage 4 breast cancer support group who, in my opinion, make the film. They're just incredible. And they talk about that experience and feeling like they are the invisible women within the breast cancer community. One of the women talks about being the elephant in the room at breast cancer support groups. It's the stage of breast cancer that no one wants to talk about. And one of the problems with research funding for biomedicine in general in the United States is that you get rewarded for asking the same questions and repeating the same kinds of experiments. And we don't know what it is that causes breast cancer to spread, which tumors are more likely to spread. And of course, that's what people die of. People don't die based on size of tumor, but very little money goes towards asking those kinds of questions. And that's something that we really need to try and change.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Jennifer. I want to talk a little bit about individual women with the breast cancer diagnosis and who is visible in the marketing, in the images and the messages of breast cancer today, and is there a place for all women in that?
No, is the short answer to that. The image of breast cancer works at a number of levels in a number of registers. If you go to a Race for the Cure event, depending on where you are in the U.S., you'll see different kinds of women, different kinds of bodies. You still will come away from that event, though, with the idea that very few people die. The only acknowledgement of death at those kinds of events is the in memory of signs that many of the participants wear on their backs. I'm actually sorry, I lost the question.
Oh, just about, are women in all stages of a breast cancer diagnosis seen and visible in this movement, and how important that is to, I guess, individual women's experience of the disease and the support that they might get?
That's a really good question, and I think that's one of the things that the Stage 4 women really emphasize in the film, is that they're not seen within the movement, and certainly there's great stigma still around not having hair, not having both your breasts. To actually appear sick, I think, is pretty difficult. And I've talked to lots and lots of women about how hard they find that the emphasis on femininity, that the marketing of the disease really promotes.
Yes, and I that you touch a little bit on, well, you have actually have a chapter in your book on that, and it's called Survival Ship. I think it's, hold on a sec. You call it Culture of Survivorship and the Tyranny of Cheerfulness. Talk a little bit more about that and just how that developed and what is available for other women. Because you're not saying, because I read your book and you're, you know, women who go to these events and find other women with a breast cancer diagnosis or family members who are there supporting their family, that's incredibly meaningful and important for women to have that shared experience. But you're saying that shared experience is limited in its expression.
Absolutely. I've talked to many women who find the Races for the Cure extremely therapeutic, to be able to be public about their diagnosis, to identify as a survivor, to meet other women with similar experiences. But the problem is that if you don't fit into that culture of survivorship, either because you don't see yourself as a survivor, because you're not feeling hopeful about your diagnosis, because you feel angry, legitimately so, for the situation you find yourself in, there's very little room for that within the mainstream breast cancer movement. I actually think in my book I underestimated the level of discomfort that many women and a few men who have breast cancer have with this, what I call the tyranny of cheerfulness. And so actually after the book came out, I heard from a woman who pointed me to a breast cancer discussion group online on one of the busiest online forums for people with breast cancer. And there were a group of women counting the days until October Breast Cancer Awareness Month was over. They experienced this as an assault on their well-being, being asked if they were aware, reminders of their disease, and very little room for any discussion of the complexity of the illness experience.
I kind of read in your book that there's different kinds of attitudes, and probably an individual woman, her attitude changes as her disease is, as she lives with her disease. There's the cancer sucks, and then there's the breast cancer is an experience, almost a rite of passage. It made me a better person. It made me stronger. You know, that they seem to be different, but I would imagine that, so there's not, it seems like you're saying there's not room for those different kinds of emotions and attitudes.
Exactly. And people do experience disease in very different ways. So for some people, breast cancer is a life-changing experience and some positive things come out of that. But we also there has to be room to talk about the ugly side of the experience. And I was especially struck by the women who I've interviewed who have a new immigrants to the U.S. and Canada who find this whole approach extremely alienating, and the lack of support for them in this situation. And you can see how that would work. I've also talked to men and to women who do not identify as feminine, who find the pink perkiness of the disease, which you're surrounded by from the moment you walk into most breast cancer clinics in North America, extremely alienating.
And when you talk about other women from other countries talking about how breast mm-hmm. cancer movement is sort of marketed and messaged, that brings me to the globalization of the pink ribbon and breast cancer in other parts of the world. And we know when we look at what do women die of worldwide, women, I guess it's 14 to 55 in other countries, are dying first of HIV/AIDS. So talk a little bit about how corporate money into breast cancer has gone overseas.
Yes, well, for about the last 10 years, we've seen an intensification of the activities of organizations like the Komen Foundation, the Avon Foundation, AstraZeneca, that makes the best-selling chemotherapy drug, tamoxifen, moving their marketing efforts overseas. And I argue in my work that what they're doing is creating a culture of breast cancer risk in places where breast cancer may not be a or the primary health concern. That's not to say that people don't get breast cancer, that people aren't concerned about breast cancer, but they have shown no evidence that they have talked to people in these locations about what their health concerns might be. And so what this does is you create a culture of risk, and at the same time you open those markets to your products. The most recent example of this is the pink ribbon, red ribbon partnership between the Komen Foundation and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton's charities to deal with breast cancer, cervical cancer, and HIV/AIDS together in Africa. And interestingly enough, this was announced just a few months after the Planned Parent controversy. And I think that's evidence that Komen, as its brand's been tarnished here in the U.S., is looking overseas more and more to promote its product and its version of breast cancer.
And you talked about, I have a minute before we have to go to an underwriter announcement here and end the show, but this risk you talked about, the entering risk, tell me a little bit more about that, what you mean by overseas. And
mm-hmm. Well, if you, as you said, if you look at breast cancer rates in less industrialized countries, particularly in the global south, Breast cancer is very low down the list of health issues that people are dealing with. The Middle East, where I've been doing some research recently, the breast cancer incidence rates are much, much lower there. Their mortality rates are a little bit higher, but still way lower than ours. But that's the disease that these corporations and nonprofit organizations have chosen to promote as the most urgent.
And once you get into that disease model, once you're diagnosed, it goes on and on, and you...
Yes, so they're promoting a biomedical model of the disease, yes, that requires screening and treatment and cure, yes.
Well, I wish we had more time, but our time is up. I want to thank Samantha King, Associate Professor with the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She's the author of the book Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy. And you can watch that. That book was made into a film tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana. You can watch the film with her and have a discussion afterwards. All the information's on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. You can find more information on how to get there. Samantha King, thank you so much.
Thank you.